Grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. It's so good to be here again with you all this morning here at Bering Drive. I'm glad for this invitation to come and share the class this morning with you in this time of reflecting on the book of Acts again. Jeff asked me to talk about something in Acts chapter 19. When you turn to Acts chapter 19, you notice this is one of the longest chapters in the book. So there's a lot to say from Acts chapter 19. Get comfortable. All right. Now I've just selected a few verses to speak about. That's the thing about Acts. There's so many great stories in this book. So much to reflect on. It's hard to choose, but I want to read a few verses for us to think about this morning. I'll begin in Acts 19 and verse 18. The setting here is Paul on his, what we call the third missionary journey, and he is in the city of Ephesus, where he stayed, it seems like the longest on any of his missionary journeys. For the better part of 3 years, he was there. In this episode, a couple of episodes here we're going to talk about happen in Ephesus. So Acts 19, verse 18. Also, many of those Ephesians who became believers confessed and disclosed their practices. A number of those who practiced magic collected their books and burned them publicly. When the value of these books was calculated, it was found to come to 50,000 silver coins. So the word of the Lord grew and mightily prevailed. About that time, no little disturbance broke out concerning the way. A man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the artisans. These he gathered together with the workers of the same trade and said, "Men, you know that we get our wealth from this business. You also see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost the whole of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and drawn away a considerable number of people by saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be scorned, and she will be deprived of her majesty that brought all Asia and the world to worship her." When they heard this, they were enraged and shouted, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" The city was filled with the confusion, and people rushed together to the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's travel companions. Paul wished to go into the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some officials of the province of Asia, who were friendly to him, sent him a message urging him not to venture into the theater. Meanwhile, some were shouting one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd gave instructions to Alexander, whom the Jews had pushed forward, and Alexander motioned for silence and tried to make a defense before the people. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, all of them shouted in unison, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." This is the word of the Lord. Throughout the book of Acts, we see the church engaged in countercultural acts. Back in chapter 17 in Thessalonica, early Christians were accused of turning the world upside down. Now that accusation, turning the world upside down, as their opponents meant it, was not true. Early Christians were not breaking Roman law. Early Christians were not being seditious. But in another sense, it was true, because early Christians were saying that there is another king besides Caesar. And this claim is at the heart of the message that would eventually turn the world upside down, the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. because of their true citizenship, because of their primary allegiance, Christians who did live their lives in accord with Roman law also engaged in acts of counterculture. Now, I should say that I hesitated to use the word counterculture this morning in the sermon title, and especially to use the word counterculture in a good way. It could be that the word counterculture comes with a lot of baggage. I think counterculture first came into our language in the 1960s. At least that may be the images that conjure up in your mind. Nonconformists who protested the Vietnam War. Hippies who promoted peace and free love. Slovenly dressed flower children who smoked marijuana and challenged what was then the traditional mores and ethics in our country. But then later on, the counterculture pretty much became the culture. And when the counterculture becomes the norm, it's hard to know what's the counterculture anymore. It's hard to know what's cool anymore. When grandmas now sport tattoos and grandpas wear ponytails, it doesn't seem quite as rebellious. It's kind of cute. Maybe there are some here, I don't know, that are doing that. So what do I mean when I say that the church is countercultural? Christianity is not countercultural simply for the sake of being contrary. It's not that because the world says X, the church must say non-X or the opposite of that. Indeed, much of what we think of as human culture is redeemable. It has been redeemed. There is much truth in human culture. I want to emphasize that. All truth, of course, is God's truth. And so Paul in Acts 17 can approvingly quote from pagan poets who have said something true about the divine nature. But what about when the principles of the culture run contrary to the principles of Christ? What about when the kingdom of the world is opposed to the kingdom of Christ? In such times and places, being a disciple of Christ means challenging the status quo in the crowd. And it means, in these circumstances, being countercultural. So in the book of Acts, we see a church that is not afraid to challenge the status quo, because theirs is a way of being and doing that doesn't answer to the Jewish Sanhedrin and doesn't curry favor or the approval of Gentile rulers. And here in Acts 19, I think we see the clear contrast. I see in these verses that I've just read at least three lies that were pervasive in the Greco-Roman world of ancient times and also still pervasive in our late modern Western world today. With each of these three lies, we see clear defiance in the way the church challenges the culture's presuppositions. And so let's notice what these three lies are and how the church in Acts 19 confronted them. The first lie is that money is power. Money is power. The new Christians here took their scrolls of sorcery, which represented what was lacking in their lives prior to Christ, and they burned them. And the value of these scrolls, Luke says, the scrolls that were burned came to 50,000 drachmas. That's about 50,000 days' wages. At bare minimum wage, at 8 hours a day, that's over $3 million today. Think of what could have been done with over $3 million. Think of the house of worship that the Ephesian church could have built for themselves. Think of how many poor people they could have helped with that money. In fact, you may remember, Paul is raising money from Gentile churches to be given to the poor churches in Jerusalem and Judea. According to Paul's letters, this is one of his main ministry goals as he goes out in these Gentile lands. Yes, Paul could have used that money. Or we could split it half for Paul and half for the Ephesian Christians. But no, they burned the scrolls. And there's no indication in the text of Paul or of anyone else second-guessing the burning of the scrolls. I think we would have second-guessed it. I would have second-guessed it. And maybe it was short-sighted. And maybe not even for the money, but for the historical value alone. Historians would love to have these scrolls. Think of the intellectual historical treasure that we would have today. What we could learn about the ancient world that the Christian gospel broke into. That was not their concern. As long as those scrolls remained, they posed a threat and a temptation to pagans and former pagans, now Christians. To them, they were not texts for historical value or curiosity, but they were real competition for their allegiance. The faith that these scrolls perpetuated could bring fleeting comfort to the people, and that's why they were tempting. But the falsehoods and the fear that's found in these scrolls meant that drastic action was necessary. And so burning them was a symbolic act that signaled their newfound and exclusive allegiance to Christ. The fact that Luke mentions the value indicates that the great value of the scrolls was noticed. But it was subordinate to the principle that money is not powerful. Our culture lies to us when it says that money is the solution. The solution to what? To everything. Try to think of a problem in society, from the fairly trivial problems to the most wicked societal problems, that people haven't tried to solve by throwing more money at it. You'd be hard-pressed to come up with a problem that people haven't tried to solve with money. In August of 2008, there was a man by the name of Robert Powell who lived in Orange Park, Florida. And he won the lottery of $12 million in change. Powell chose the lump sum, which gave him, after taxes and everything, a little over $6 million. Okay. He decided to tithe it, and so he donated $600,000 to his church, Orange Park First Baptist. The church refused the donation. Now, I don't want to get into the fact that Powell was offended by this refusal, and that he was the one who took this story to the media, and that the church did not speak to the media. But I'm interested in the perspective from the church's side. This has to be one of the most countercultural things that I've ever heard of a church doing. And I don't know their reasoning for sure, because they didn't speak to the media that I know of, but I can tell you this much. If Orange Park First Baptist Church is like every other church that I've ever known, they were praying for more resources. They were praying for more money. They needed more funds to accomplish good in the name of Christ. Imagine the discussions in the committee meeting when this money was offered. The noble wish lists, and the even maybe not quite so noble. The missionaries that we've wanted to support. The pastor's raise. The benevolence ministry. The new gym we've wanted. The more comfortable chairs. The better sound system. And on and on. Whatever their reason for refusing the donation, it could not have been an easy decision for them. It had to be tempting to just quietly accept that money. Now, I personally think that that church made the right decision. If it's a church that takes a stand, a moral stand against gambling, then it would be wrong for them to accept that money. But even if you think they made the wrong decision, okay, even if you think they should have taken the money, at the very least, you have to respect that they stood by their principles in the face of what must have been a very powerful temptation. Now, money, of course, is necessary for survival. Certain resources, of course, are essential for effective ministry. In the book of Acts, for example, the poor Christians are sustained by wealthy church members, generous Christians who have the means. Luke goes out of his way to point out as a good example Barnabas, who's singled out as a generous donor in the church. We're commanded, of course, to be generous and thoughtful with our God-given resources. But when the question is about power and what the church depends on, it's not money. The church does not sacrifice principle for a little more cash flow. And that's what's countercultural here. Money is power? No. When you read through the book of Acts, you get the sense that the church is very powerful, but never does its power derive from its financial resources. The second lie that's common in our culture and that I think we see here in this story in Acts 19 is that idols are valuable. Idols are valuable. Yeah, there are many Ephesian idols in this story in Acts 19. There's the most obvious idol, that is, the idols themselves, the little souvenirs that Demetrius and his friends sold, representing their city's patron goddess, Artemis. With these idols, along with the t-shirts and the shot glasses, you could commemorate your visit to one of the ancient seven wonders of the world, the great temple of Artemis. But those literal idols represent something much more important to the silversmith guild. They represent another idol, which overlaps with the first point, and that is money. Profit, a bustling Ephesian economy. These Ephesians make money off their religion. Paul's preaching against idols and then their swift reaction to it point out and reflect how important these idols were to them. In order to appeal, though, to the larger public, Demetrius and his friends offer a more noble reason for opposing Paul. It's not just about their idols and their money. They argue that the great reputation of Artemis herself, and therefore of their city and the temple, was all at stake here. Paul's message, they claim, threatens to discredit her temple and to rob, as it says, the goddess of her divine majesty, verse 27. Well, hers must have been a fragile majesty. The Ephesians had many idols. It's hard to say exactly which is the most important idol to these people, the silver trinkets themselves, or the prophet that they bring in, or the nature of the goddess, or the magnificent temple dedicated to her, or their city, or their own self-interest in all of these things. They seem devoted to all of the above. But it doesn't really matter which was the most important idol to them. Anything other than primary devotion to the true God is idolatry. Anything placed ahead of or alongside God in life is idolatry. And our culture lies to us when it says, religion is okay as long as you keep it private. Don't bring it out into the open. Let it have its little corner in your life alongside other allegiances in your life. You've got your family over here, and your job, your school, your hobbies, sports, extracurricular activities, friends, your position. Don't let your private religious opinions interfere in any of these areas, especially the public ones. Well, this is the status quo that Paul challenged, and the same one that we must challenge. The gods of this age must be confronted. The difficulty often is to recognize them in our own lives. Idolatry, even the most subtle variety, is condemned then and now. Whether it's a handheld trinket, or the profit margin, or the fame and reputation, or the country, or simple self-interest. Anything that causes us to set our love for God off to the side, anything that compromises our devotion to God, is an idol. The town clerk goes on after the verses I read to quiet the crowd, asking them to disperse. And his rationale seems convincing to them. I'll paraphrase his argument. It is, "Don't worry, Artemis has been around for a long time before Paul, and she will endure forever. So let's not lose our cool. Go back to your idols." Idols are valuable and worthy? No. And so I can't help but point out that the temple of Artemis and devotion to her did not last forever. They went the way of all idols and of anything that is not God. The third lie that I see here in Acts 19 and also in our own culture is that might makes right. Might makes right. Or better, noise makes right. Numbers make right. The crowd makes right. Rather than engaging the content of Paul's message, we see here in Ephesus a mob marching through the streets and gathering in the amphitheater. Now, mob by definition is senseless and dangerous. Mob reasoning means shouting down the opposition. For 2 hours straight, it says, they shout, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," as if they actually might doubt it. Obviously, the level of discourse is very low at this point. But because quantity can be said to have a quality all of its own, because we have lots of people yelling very loudly, then maybe Artemis must be great. It must be so. As is typical with a mob, though, Luke points out that the majority of the crowd didn't even know why they were there. Some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another. They simply enjoyed tipping over the car. It doesn't take long to see the frightful parallel in our own society. Apparently, in light of what we were fed by the media, there is no appetite or audience anymore for an actually civil, actual debate. Civil discourse accompanied by cool-headed reasoning does not make for a good soundbite these days. It's hard to lay out 3 reasons for and against a certain important position in 140 characters or less on Twitter. In that medium, there's no room anymore for an indefinite article, much less for a rational argument. What there is room for, though, is insults. If you don't agree with one side, you are crooked and crazy and stupid. The takers. If you don't unqualifiedly embrace and approve the other side, you're a bigot or a fill-in-the-blank phobe. Shouting down is the new order, and as in the ancient Ephesian theater, many of the most vocal don't even know what they're saying or why they're saying it. They do not take a moment to ponder the consequences of what they say. What are we to do when might and noise are the order of the day? I don't have all the answers, but I do see 2 very practical things in this text. First, don't be intimidated by it. The crowd has not always been a good judge of truth. In fact, if the crowd is overwhelmingly for something, that alone may be a good reason to question it. Paul and the early Christians were not intimidated or silenced. As in the first century, Artemis seemed great, and a horde of people could shout about it for 2 hours straight with a straight face. How silly it seems to us now, Artemis. Don't be intimidated. This year, something or someone else may seem great, but fads pass. Second, there's no need to try to engage mob reasoning, especially on its own terms. Paul may have wanted to enter the theater for a moment, we see, but wiser friends kept him from that idea. In fact, Alexander the Jew went in, and it says, tried to reason with them, and they shouted him down. So we're not intimidated, but we also don't need to enter that theater. Shouting back does not usually help the cause of Christ. Joining in the insults will probably be ineffective. Instead, have the civil discourse with those who will listen. Prepare the arguments and reasons for those who have an ear to hear. Be ready to speak the truth to power when the noise fades. Finally, as we reflect on these specific lies that were prominent in the ancient culture and still taken for granted today, and as we contemplate how God's people have responded then and still ought to respond to these presuppositions, let us seek wisdom from God's Spirit. Again, not every aspect of culture is equally good or equally bad. And nothing in human culture is beyond the redemptive reach of God, whose Son has conquered all enemies, including sin and death. It is through His death and resurrection that we have hope, both for this world and for the next, the restoration of all things back to God. So let us view this temporary culture through an eternal perspective. Let us stand with the culture when it speaks and acts in truth. But at the same time, let us not hesitate to resist it and challenge it when it speaks and acts falsely. Because we are citizens not of this world, but of God's kingdom. And the people of God march to a different drumbeat. So may we listen carefully for that rhythm. May we conform ourselves to it. And may we then keep in step with the Spirit. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.